The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture, titled Rav Yaakov Beirav and the Great Smicha Controversy, is dedicated to the memory and honor of Rabbi Yochanan Zweig, Rabbi Alon Tolwin, and Rabbi Shmuel Irons and their families.
Certain cities evoke vivid images. Take New York City. In your mind's eye, you see thousands upon thousands of pedestrians and cars pushing and rushing through the streets of this commercial capital. Or perhaps you envision the Twin Towers, once the symbol of power and wealth of New York City, and now has become the symbol of tragedy, heroism, and miracles. Say Athens, it'll probably stir up the images of the Parthenon, the Acropolis, and the names of Pericles, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Rome, the Colosseum, and the Vatican. Lahavdil, in contrast, Yerushalayim, Jerusalem, for some, that name summons up the image of the Knesset, or the Hebrew University. But for many others, Jerusalem means the old city and the Kotel, the Western Wall, the neighborhoods of Geula, Meyashorim, Matzdorf, Ezra's Torah, Har Nof, and the thousands upon thousands of saints, scholars, students, and other holy people who bravely dedicate their lives to make the holiest of all cities their home. But there's one city that is beyond any comparison. Say the name Tzfat, Tzfat, Safed, and your name is filled with images, and your mind is filled with the images of the mysterious and the spiritual. In the 16th century, its narrow streets led to the homes of some of the greatest mystics, Mekubalim, and Talmudic sages ever produced by the Jewish people. It was in its surrounding fields that the prayer L'Chodoidi was sung by the Arizal, Rav Yitzchak Luria and his followers, as they waited for the Shechina, divine presence, symbolized by the Shabbos Queen, to touch the essence of their souls. It was here that the Sefer Beis Yosef and Shulchan Aruch were completed. To this very day, it is still associated with mysticism and inspiration. This was not always so, however. In ancient times, it was a very obscure town. It is not mentioned in all of Tanakh, the Bible. It is mentioned, however, in passing by Josephus, this is on paragraph B in the first page, as one of the areas in the Upper Galilee that he fortified in the years 66 to 70 in preparation for the war with the Romans. Rabbi Elozer Kalir, in his kinos, in his dirges, which were cited on Tisha B'Av, records a tradition that Tzfas, Safed, was the home of the clan of Yochim, one of the 24 Mishmoros, clans of priests. In an alternate version, it was the Mishmor, the clan of Pashchor, who lived in Tzfas. This is in paragraph A. From that same source, it seems that Tzfas and its citizens became one of the casualties of the Roman War. In Talmudic times, it is mentioned in the Talmud Yerushalmi, which we quote on paragraph C. At the time of the Crusades, Safed was the leading city in the Galilee, the site of a major fortress and the place of several important battles. It would seem, however, that in the period of Crusader rule, which was often intolerant of Jews, the Jewish population of Safed was non-existent, or at least not very significant, and hence there is no mention of the city in the accounts of the famous Jewish travelers, Rabbi Binyamin of Tudela, Rabbi Psach of Regensburg, who visited Eretz Yisrael during this period in the 1170s and 80s. In the year 1188, the fortress, which was manned by the Knights Templar, most formidable of the Crusader forces, was captured by Saladin. Yeah, this is the second. Under the Muslims, who are generally more tolerant of the Jews than were the Christians, Tzfas once again became a major Jewish settlement. In the account of Rav Shmuel ben Shimshon, who made a pilgrimage to Eretz Yisrael in the year 1210, together with the famed Rav Yonasan HaKohen of Luniel, after describing the various kvorim, tombs of the great tzaddikim, the saints, which he visited in the Galilee, he writes the following, quote, "From there we came to Kfar Amuka, and we found the kever, the tomb of Yonasan ben Uziel, on which there is a great tree. The Muslims bring oil to it and have a light burning there in his honor. They make their vows there too in his glory. On leaving Kfar Amuka, we came to Kfar Nabarta, or Akbara. We found the tomb of Rabbi Meir. We returned from here to Safed, where we spent the Shabbos. In these places, there are Jewish communities number in each case more than five times the minion of 10. So there are communities of over 50 Jews. In the year 1216, we find that Safed was the home of one of the giants of Jewry, Rabbi Tzadik, a former Rosh Yeshiva, head of the yeshiva of Yeshiva's Gaon Yaakov, but would seem to be this Yeshiva Gaon Yaakov, the yeshiva referring to the yeshiva in Baghdad. On the top of page 2, we cite the account of Yehuda, says Al-Acharizi's travels to Tzfas and his meeting with Rav Tzadik. In the year 1240, the Crusaders again captured Safed, and the Templars rebuilt their fortress. By the year 1266, however, the Crusaders had finally been vanquished from Tzfas by the famed Egyptian Mamluk Sultan Baybars, and returned again to the control of the Muslims. They remained in that control up until modern era. During the subsequent period, we find not only a Jewish community in Tzfas and Safed, but also a Beis Din, a Jewish court of law, which would indicate that it was a community of considerable standing. In the year 1288, we note on paragraph E that the Beis Din in Tzfas was headed by Rav Moshe ben Yehuda HaKohen, and it supported the Nogid, Rav David, as this was the leader of Egyptian Jewry, the Rambam's grandson, and the Nossi, the exilarch of Damascus, Rav Yishai ben Chizkiya, in their struggle against Rav Shlomo Petit, who had attempted to ban the study of the Mora Nevuchim, the guide of the perplexed, and the other studies of the Rambam, because of its reliance upon Greek philosophy. So this Rav Shlomo Petit, who was a Mekubal, was a Kabbalist, was active in garnering support from European, the greats of European Jewry, to support the ban of the study of Maimonides. In other words, his philosophical sections, the Guide of the Perplexed. In honor of the Rambam, because they felt it was an offense directly to the honor of the Rambam, the Beis Din of Safed issued a cherem, writ of excommunication against Rav Shlomo Petit and his followers at the grave of the Rambam. They went to Tveria and they gathered there, it seems, the Beis Din of Safed together with the Beis Din, the court of Akko, to issue this writ of excommunication, and wrote a letter of support for the Nossi, in other words, exilarch, the head of the Damascus community. The community in Safed, again, here this is we quote from this on page 2 in paragraph E. The community of Safed seems to have maintained its continuity, for we find in the year 1322, the Eshtori HaParchi, in his work Kafta Vaferach, notes that, quote, "In Safed there is a large community, may Hashem protect them," end quote. From another source we know that Tzfas, approximately the year 1496, during the Mamluk or Egyptian rule, had some 300 families. He had grown over the years, most of whom were were of Mistarabim, Jews from Arabic countries, and a minority were Sephardim, Jews from Spain. We also know of a Rabbi Iskandri who lived in Safed in the late 1400s, quoted in the Tshuvas, in the response of the Radvaz, Rav Dov ben Zimro, the chief rabbi of Egypt, whom we've covered in the previous lecture. We also discussed in the previous lecture the life of Yosef Saragossi, the Rebbe, the mentor of the Radvaz, and a man of great stature, who settled in Safed in approximately the year 1496 and left his imprint on that city. But truth be told, that during the whole time we just covered, Safed was still only one of perhaps hundreds of such cities with a relatively large Jewish population. The event that eventually changed Sfas, Safed, from being a relatively minor Jewish center to its being the premier city of the Jewish people was the conquest of the Mamluk Empire by the Ottoman Emperor Selim I in the year 1516 and 1517. Now under the Turks, especially Selim's successor Suleiman the Magnificent, the Jews enjoyed a secure position and Sfas started growing exponentially, became an agricultural and commercial center. This is how one traveler to Sfas, says David de Rossi, describes the situation in the year 1535. And we'll read this together on page 2. He who saw Safed 10 years ago and observes it now has the impression of a miracle, for more Jews are arriving here continually, and the tailoring trade grows daily. I have been told that more than 15,000 suits have been manufactured in Safed during this year, besides fancy suits. Every man and every woman who works wool and fabric earns an abundant living. I have, from other sources, it seems that the influx of Sephardim, who were actually well-educated, was beyond the education given in the Arabic countries, brought with them skills and know-how that made Sfas, you know, such a commercial, a manufacturing center. And he continues on, this is David L. Rossi, de Rossi. Hatred of the Jews is in contrast to our homeland unknown here, as he came from Italy. So, and the Turks hold the Jews in esteem. In this country and in Egypt, Jews are the chief officers and administrators of the customs. No injuries are perpetuated against them in the whole empire. Only this year, in consequence of the extraordinary expenditure caused by the war against Persia, were the Jews asked to make advances of loans to the princes. All articles of commerce are available in these countries. Fibers, spun and unspun, are exported from Safed in great quantities. Also oil, honey, and small quantities of silk. From other countries we get all kinds of spices such as pepper, musket nuts, ginger, and cane spices. Many people, among them also Jews, buy these goods for selling. Some merchants trade with the Jews for exchanges an amount of over 10,000 in each transaction. And it continues on, my dear wife Sora, since she has come to Safed, has recovered with the help of God. For the water and air are unusually good. Only few illnesses occur here. Therefore, the medical art does not flourish, and the physicians do not earn much money. Sick people eat big or small cucumbers, gourds, and many kinds of fruit. During this period of economic growth, Sfas also attracted ever-increasing numbers of scholars, who were often directly supported by donations from abroad, and indirectly by the tax subsidy given to them by the local community. This is how Rav Yosef Karo, who settled in Sfas in the year 1536, describes in one of his tshuvas, responsa, the situation. Here's on page 4. And he begins poetically, "Hear, O mountains, the Lord's controversy, and you strong foundations of the earth, the zeal of my beloved regarding his vineyard, my well-beloved has a vineyard and a very fruitful hill. For when God saw the suffering of his people Israel, which has lasted some 1,500 years, in which they were banished from their land and exiled from nation to nation, from one kingdom to another, and experienced so many exiles and forced conversions, he remembered the covenant of their forebears and caused their captivity to return and gathered them from the ends of the earth. They came one survivor from a city and two from a clan to the land of desire, Israel, and they settled in the city of Safed, Sfas, the most sought-after place in the world. At that time, their leaders acted properly to relieve the tax burden of the poor and destitute and the students of Torah as well, and they would free them from paying the poll tax. If someone had a limited ability to pay, they would take something from him. From some a half, and from others a quarter of their taxes. From Torah scholars, they would not generally take anything, with the exception of someone of limited capital from whom they would take half of their tax payment. This practice applies solely to poll tax. Regarding the other taxes and levies, it was inconceivable for the community to ask payment from anyone whom the Torah was their chief livelihood and only worked on the side. The honor and awe of the Torah was constantly uppermost in the minds of the leaders of the community. They wouldn't do anything while consulting the sages, the elder rabbis. Everything was done according to the guidelines which they set. In this manner, God's vineyard, the house of Israel, was beautifully tended and pleasant. The vines blossomed and the pomegranates budded. The Rosh Hashiva and their students studied in their place without disturbance. They didn't hear the sound of oppressor. The vineyard was walled in and its stones were removed by the philanthropic members of the nation and the God of Abraham, of Avram, who lived in the diaspora. Now there's the philanthropic members who lived in the diaspora, who provided them with food, and they planted within it a sapling. Again, this is all the imagery of the vineyard. As a result, a powerful central tower was built, the study of Torah with great diligence. But he continues, so this already is the picture of the community. So really it's a Torah community. But he continues on that there was a change. As a result of the abundance of the sin of the generation, the Satan, Satan became jealous and put in the hearts of Yehuda of Berlin, this person, to also emigrate to the desirous land Israel, and he laid plans to destroy the ramparts of Torah, to throw off its yoke from him, so that the fear of Torah scholars should not be placed upon the wealthy, but rather the fear of the wealthy should be placed upon the Torah scholars. In addition, he wanted to relieve himself of the burden of paying taxes and levies on behalf of the poor and destitute. To that end, he convened a meeting of the officers of the communities. And the communities meaning, as we're going to see, that like that there were different synagogues, you know, different communities, depending from where they originally emigrated. And told them that it is only fitting that every single Jewish member of the community, rich or poor, should inscribe his name in the pincus, the public tax register. The officers of the community told them that we must first ask the Torah authorities and seek counsel from them, as is our custom. He replied, quote, "If you do that, it is certain they will object to this. Therefore, I advise you to hurry and implement this change. Don't be afraid of the rabbis. What can they do to you?" End quote. This is how he enticed them until they finally agreed to his proposal. He even had the gall to show the written agreement to one of the elder rabbis. As he finished reading it, this fellow Yehuda asked the rabbi, quote, "What do you say about this?" He replied, "I hear, you know, Zakas Stoim Vamoira Ki Rabba, the cries of Sodom and Gomorrah, for they are overwhelming. It is evident that the impoverished will be at the mercy of severe tax enforcers, and their cries, screams, and wails will go up to heaven, but there will be no one to save them." He paid no attention to the rabbi's words. On the contrary, he became even more entrenched in his evil and sinful ways, and continued to do whatever he pleased. He made sure that the names of all of the poor and destitute were written into the pincus, this tax register, even those who lived solely on charitable aid, as well as the names of all the desperately poor students of Torah from the age of 15 and above. including those who did not own 1 hour's worth of sustenance and lived solely on the meager rations provided by the Jews in the diaspora. They would take their very sustenance from their mouths to pay the poll tax. And it continues on, the following is the text of the writ of excommunication issued by the undersigned rabbis. And he quote, the heads of the communities of the city of Safed decided to impose the burden of taxation upon these Torah scholars who have capital and started to collect it from them. It would seem that there had already been somewhat of a compromise. I mean, they ceased collecting it directly from the most desperately, you know, but they decided at least to take it from Torah scholars who at least had some means to pay the tax. And he continues on, when we warned them of the severity of the matter, they are in violation of the Torah, prophets, and holy writings. For the opinion of all of the sages from the times of Moses until the present, they listened to us, not only ceased the collections, they also returned the monies already collected. For according to the Talmud, that actually taxes of this nature are not paid by Torah scholars. In order that such a thing not occur again over the passage of time, we hereby declare anyone in violation to be excommunicated, and he goes in great detail of the curses of the excommunication. May all of the curses of the Torah befall such a person. This declaration is in effect from now until Messianic times, and it's signed by Rav Yosef Karo, Rav Yosef ben Meir de Corio, Rav Moshe ben Yosef of Trani, known as the Mabit. These were the leading rabbis in Sfas at the time. This was tax that had to be paid to the Turkish government, and they demanded that all citizens pay the tax. This was a poll tax, besides other taxes. What had been the custom previously was the community as a whole paid the poll tax of the destitute and the Torah scholars. This Yehuda of Berlin wanted to change the practice, and this was the response. Rav Moshe of Trani, known as the Mabit, one of the signers of the previously mentioned ban, the Cherem, and one of the outstanding scholars of the time, gives us yet another insight into the life of Safed during that time in the following tshuva. It should be on page 6. All of the Torah scholars who have not paid taxes until now is due to the fact that their chief occupation day and night is the study of Torah. They leave their homes only for a short period during the day in order to oversee that their work, which others are doing on their behalf, is faithfully executed to provide for their food and other needs. Afterwards, without wasting any time on trivial pursuits, they immediately return to their true profession, which is the study of Torah. The non-learning time that they spend is strictly enough to provide for their needs, so they need not be supported by the community, not to become wealthy. Those wealthy scholars who originally came from the outside of Eretz Yisrael, of Israel, only acquired their wealth over there. This is because it was customary for men of means to provide scholars with merchandise so they could easily resell it to make a profit. It is therefore fitting that the leaders of the city, continues on, not to alter the boundaries that were fixed by early sages, Zal, of blessed memory, and those that come after them, who expounded upon the scriptures, which are the source of the exemption of Torah scholars from all forms of taxation. Such a thing was not done in more than in 40 years since the surge of immigration to Eretz Yisrael, in other words, to ask Torah scholars to contribute to the taxes. It would be akin, if only, the fact is that synagogues, you know, the residences of the priests or the ministers or rabbis, you know, of the churches, the synagogues, are exempt from taxes, of property tax. It's really to encourage, basically, in the community that such institutions exist, which they feel is to the benefit of the community as a whole. Similarly, really the taxes were not, basically, it's really to encourage Torah scholarship. And evidently it would seem just from the above that if the taxation would have been imposed upon Torah scholars, it would have been a tremendous pressure for them to leave their studies. But whatever the reasoning is, it is really this, it's based on the Gemara in Bava Basra and Daf Ches, that in 8a about the patur, about the exemption of taxes by Torah scholars. Tzfas, during this period, was the center of a truly golden age in Jewish history. This is how Rav Yom Tov Tzalon, one of the leading scholars at the end of the 16th century, describes the period. I remember that when I was young, the city of our God was filled with all manner of praise, wealth, and honor, and the great elderly holy rabbis, Rav Yosef Karo, Rav Yisrael Kareel, and Rav Moshe Trani, their portion is now bound in eternal life. And as I remember, that was the golden age. From yet another tshuva responsum of the Mabit, we get yet another glimpse of the dynamics of Tzfas during that time. And he writes here on page 7, since the days of my youth, from the year 5281, that would be equivalent to the year 1521, I took a leadership role in Safed in all manners dealing with the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael. From then on until the present, this eve of Rosh Hashanah, I have expounded on the questions that were posed to me. I have made myself available to respond to all that the Sephardic, the Spanish Jews, who came here to Safed, requested of me. God has inspired me to rebuild the ruins of Safed, and I supervise the great building activity so that no one encroaches upon the boundaries of another. I adjudicate all of the distribution of land as well as issues of invasion of privacy and blocking of light that come about through building on adjacent lots. So again, we have the sense of how the community was being built. I mean, there was an awful lot of, when people are coming, there were new buildings that needed to be built. And the Mabit, as one of the leading Torah scholars, took an active role in adjudication. And it continues on during all of these years, as the different communities with their distinctive native tongues separated and built synagogues, were involved in enacting ordinances for all of the communities. These ordinances mandated all new immigrants who originate from the Turkish Empire, as well as from all other countries, to attach themselves solely to the synagogue of their respective communities. This was done in order to facilitate support for the poor of that distinctive community. As if you came from Germany, as you were told that you have to daven, you have to be part of the German community, and that would help the other German Jews. A person of means would come, he would share in the burden of that community. Because the Sephardim, the exile of Spain, formed the majority of the Safed community, they needed two synagogues. One is called Kahal Gadol, and the other is Kahal Yaakov. Originally, there was a unified collection distribution system for both synagogues for charities, taxes, and levies, as they were actually one distinct linguistic group. Afterwards, because of differences of opinion, the two synagogues separated and supervised their own collections and distributions for the poor of their respective communities and for everything else. We instituted that any Sephardic Jew that moves to Safed can freely join the synagogue of his choice, that no synagogue infringe upon the other. Every year we jointly sign a letter addressed to all of the holy congregation of the city to help support the indigent of our communities. Which is just interesting, as it was pointed out before. Even though this was a center of wealth, but there was a very large indigent population as well. Because of this, money comes in every year for all of the poor. In addition, this also spurs the wealthy to come to give special donations, a commemoration of the pilgrims who came every holiday with donations in the times of the temple. So this is, like in the holidays, this is their donation, their gift to God, so to speak, to give to the poor. Because of this renaissance of Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael, issues that had not been widely discussed over 1,000 years. You know, how to follow the halachas, the laws that apply uniquely to Eretz Yisrael, were now a subject of discussion and debate. At the bottom of page 7, we quote from a tshuva of the Mabit regarding the responsibility to provide the Kohanim, the priests, with their special entitlements. The Zroya, Lechoyayim, and Keva, the foreleg, cheeks, and the mar, stomach of every slaughtered domesticated animal. On page 8, this is in paragraph J, we quote from a tshuva from the Mabit regarding Shemitah. And he writes, for the last 28 years, from the year 5292, this is 1532, until the year 5321, this is probably the year 1560, four Shemitahs in all, I have been involved in the halachic issues of produce growing on non-Jewish land in Eretz Yisrael, regarding to the laws of Shemitah and regarding the requirement of taking truma and maaseres, tithes, if that grain was processed, the smarchu, by a Jew. I've already written my opinion that the grain is free from the requirement of tithing. In other words, the opinion is produce, which is grown in Eretz Yisrael, has to be, according to Torah law, has to be tithed. There's a portion that's given approximately a 2%, which is given to the priests, the Kohanim, at least in temple times. There's a problem now of identification of the Kohanim, and also is a problem of them eating the truma, which they have to be they have to be tohar, they have to be ritually pure, which really is not possible if anyone came in contact with a dead body or was at a funeral, you know, in the same room with a dead body. And the only way to eradicate the tumma, the ritual impurity, would be through the ashes of the red heifer, which we don't have today. So even though the truma was separated, actually in practicality was not given to the Kohanim. But there's other tithes. There's two tithes. There's Maaser Rishon, the first tithe, which is given to the Levites, and Maaser Sheni, which is taken and eaten in Jerusalem, or its monetary equivalent. And really, produce in Israel, at least one has to go through the tithing process in order to enable one to eat the remainder. There's a question of produce grown in the Shemitah year, the seventh year. The seventh year is normally, for instance, outside of the normative cycle of the tithing. You know, it's the tithing cycle is a 6-year cycle, and then there's the free seventh year, the Shemitah. Second of all, there's the factor that produce is hefker, is really ownerless during the seventh year. One is required to make it available for anyone to take, and that itself would make it exempt from the laws of tithing. The question is, that's all true of produce grown on Jewish lands. What about produce grown on lands that in Israel that were sold or owned by non-Jews? Does that change the status?
Grown by Jews?
No. Grown by, you know, the land was sold and it's grown by non-Jews in Israel. How does that affect its status vis-a-vis the Shemitah year, the seventh year? According to the Mabit, even if it's sold, it's owned, the land is owned by non-Jews, it still retains all the sanctity, the produce of produce grown the seventh year, and is out of the whole Shemitah cycle. In other words, tithes do not have to be taken. Because if one buys the produce, you know, from a non-Jewish farmer, they're a farmer, one would not have to take tithes. And and actually the laws of Shemitah would apply. There's other, it goes beyond this class, but there are other restrictions about the eating of law of produce in the Shemitah year. And he continues on the Mabit. Now in this Shemitah I've seen that the Chochem of Yosef, from Yosef Karo, may Hashem help him, who has issued a ruling to separate Truma and Maaseres. Rav Yosef Karo maintains that produce grown on non-Jewish land, even though it is, it has sanctity, as he maintains that Trumas and Maestras have to be separated from it, but the laws of Shemitah do not apply to it. So therefore, says that we deal with it as if that produce would be like imported from outside of Israel. I mean, he still maintains that regarding Trumas and Maestras, in other words, the tithes have to be taken out of it. It is actually grown in Israel, but vis-a-vis the laws of Shemitah, the seventh year, there's no sanctity to those, to that fruit. This, by the way, is a subject of much learned debate, which has ramification today in Israel, with regards to produce which is grown on non-Jewish land, and the sale of Jewish land to non-Jews. Again, according to the Mabit, land in Israel which is owned by non-Jews still retains Kedusha Shvius, still has the sanctity of the seventh year. According to Yosef Karo, it does not. And generally, practice is to rely upon Rav Yosef Karo. But even that, there is a question, and even one does rely on Rav Yosef Karo regarding the restrictions about the produce, about eating it, etc. But there's another question about how does it affect working the land. We see that in terms of, according to Rav Yosef Karo, Trumas and Maestras, giving the tithes, he maintains that this is Israel. The tithes have to be taken off. So there's a whole question, therefore, well, maybe I can't work the land either. It's only a special exemption of the fruits. You know, because the fruits were really owned by the fruits were never declared to be hefker, unowned, because they were owned by a non-Jew. And Rav Yosef Karo, according to at least one opinion, that which frees one from Maestras, from the tithes, is not so much it's grown in the seventh year, but rather one is required to make it ownerless. You have to give it up. The produce on the seventh year has to be given. But if it's grown by a non-Jew, the non-Jew does not have that requirement. So it is privately owned. So therefore it's privately owned, so it's like privately owned in the third year, in the fourth year of the seventh year cycle. Well, privately owned. So therefore, if you buy it, you have to take off tithes. Whereas the Mabit maintains just being in the seventh year itself exempts one from tithes. But it does not really, this is the issue of having it owned by a non-Jew, does it exempt the land from being worked, is a totally different question. But these were issues that there was Negea, and as they touched their very lives then, because there were finally Jews, I mean, many of them were owning farms. And their Jews were buying produce from non-Jews, and they would finish the process. There's Nismarchu, and as it had been, this is produce over here grown on non-Jewish land. And it was bought by the Jews, or was harvested by the Jews. They had the right, or they rented the land, and they had the right to harvest it, and they finished the whole process. So under this circumstance, so these were the circumstances we're talking about. These were produce that was grown on non-Jewish land, processed by Jews, that if had this been in the third year or the fifth year or whatever, one would have to take tithes. And the question now is, what about the seventh year? Is that different or not? And this was really, but again, just gives the indication of these were the issues, and they were not asked before because they really didn't have the critical mass of Jews. But here there were many Jews, and they were occupied in various professions, and one of them was farming. The leading rabbinic figure in Tzfas, in the early period of its tremendous growth, was Rav Yaakov Bei Rav, or commonly known as Mahari Bei Rav. He originally was born and raised in Spain, as he writes in the Tshuva, this is on page 8. I, the writer of these words, Yaakov, who is called Bei Rav, who was from the exiles of Castile, from the city of Makeda, this is on page 8, from the province of Toledo, from the family of Maimon Gil. He was regarded by many of his contemporaries as the leading Torah sage of his generation. He evidently was a child prodigy, and studies it seemed under the last Gaon of Spain, Rav Yitzchak Abohav, in the city of Toledo. He left Spain in 1492 and eventually arrived in Fez, Morocco. In a tshuva, in responsum, he describes his arrival in Fez in the following words. It's on page 9. From the time of the expulsion of forced conversion in Spain and on, I, Yaakov Beirav, have always been a halachic guide and rov. At that time, I was 18 years of age, and I was the rov of 5,000 Jewish households in the province of Fez, as is well known throughout the world. I didn't even have a beard at the time, and there were great sages who lived there at the time. Despite the fact that I suffered from hunger and thirst, utterly lacking any comfort, I have walked in Hashem Yisborach's ways, and I engrossed myself in his Torah. Shortly afterwards, perhaps after the outbreak of plague in Fez in 1493, as we discussed in the previous lecture, he traveled from Fez, which is in Morocco, to Talmison, an old established community in Algeria. This is what a contemporary of his, Avram ben Gabishon, writes. Here, this is on number 3. Don't say that the wisdom of our sages and the men of discernment is lost or hidden, since Yaakov Beirav has arisen and come to live in our land amongst us. It's not clear how long he spent in Talmison. There seems to be support that he eventually returned back to Fez. In the year 1510, North Africa was overrun by the Spanish. And it seems that the Maribe Rav fled to Egypt, where he became a member of the Beis Din of Rav Yitzchak Shalel. Somewhere around 1516, the Maribe Rav established a yeshiva in Yerushalayim, which lasted until the middle of 1519, when Jerusalem experienced a terrible famine and Rav Yaakov was forced to go back to Egypt with his yeshiva. This is how Rav Yisrael Ashkenazi of Perusha, who lived in Yerushalayim at the time, describes the events. It's on page 10. And he says, regarding the yeshiva and the study of Torah, you should know, this is about Jerusalem, you should know that there are two yeshivas. They are, however, lost and irretrievable, and as they're in a terrible state of disrepair, these two yeshivas. We used to learn more in one day in depth than we now learn in a month. For there is no student of Torah here that descends into the depths of the sugya, the Talmudic subject matter, especially with Tosfos. There used to be a great scholar who could uproot mountains by the name of Yaakov Beirav, being left to go to Egypt, and all of the distinguished students left here as well to save themselves from the famine. For no one earns here even a pruta, a penny or piasta. He repeatedly told me to go to yeshiva in Egypt, and he promised me great things, but I did not want to leave Jerusalem. Eventually, Rav Yaakov Beirav left Egypt, and in 1524 he arrived in Sfas, arrived in Safed. It seems that in the first years there he traveled to various communities. On page 10, number 6, we quote his description of his stay in Damascus. In Israel, as in other places, he lived and influenced. He was held in the highest regard, and it seems he wielded much authority. And this is what we see on the we quote in the bottom of page 10. You know that this is when Marie Barav is writing to the Mabit. As it teaches our master, the Nogid. Some historians maintain that he even had a position of Nogid at the time, which was the leader of Egyptian-Israeli Jewry. And he says, if he does not, referring to the issue at hand, if he does not accept the judgment, write to us and we'll inflict corporal punishment. Due to his influence and stature, the Maribe Rav was chosen to be the first somuch, the first legally appointed or ordained dayan rabbinic judge in over 1,000 years. He was 64 at the time. We will soon explain the process of smicha and its significance in greater detail. In the year 1541, at the age of 67, Rav Yaakov Beirav passed away. His influence and teachings were carried on by his disciples, Rav Moshe Troni, Rav Yosef Karo, and a host of others. Rav Yaakov Beirav was not the only one that received smicha at the time. Immediately after his appointment, you know, as this judge, and we're going to explain this in greater detail, he appointed his prestigious colleague, the leading rabbi of Yerushalayim, of Jerusalem, Rav Levi ibn Chaviv. Rav Levi, however, did not accept the appointment for reasons we will soon discuss. As we mentioned before, Rav Levi ibn Chaviv, or is called the Maral Bach, was the leading rabbi of Yerushalayim. He, like the Maribe Rav, was originally from Spain. From Spain, however, he went not to Fez, as the Maribe Rav went, but he went to Portugal. And after the forced conversions there in 1497, he, together with his father, Rav Yaakov ibn Chaviv, the author of the Ein Yaakov, and one of the leading scholars of the day, made their way to Salonika, where they had a great hand in making it one of the leading Torah centers of the world, which we discussed in the last lecture, in the two lectures ago. Rav Shmuel di Medina, the Marash Dam, was one of Rav Levi's disciples. Around the year 1524, Rav Levi left Salonika and came to Yerushalayim. Unlike Tzfas, life in Yerushalayim was very difficult. This is how Rav Avadya Bartanura, the author of the famous commentary to the Mishnah, describes life there in the year 1488. This is on page 13, paragraph B. Yerushalayim is, for the most part, desolate and in ruins. I need not repeat that it is not surrounded by walls. This is in 1488. And the walls that we see today were erected at the behest of Suleiman the Magnificent. He came to power in 1520. So this is in 1488. Its inhabitants, I am told, number about 4,000 families. As for Jews, about 70 families of the poorest class have remained. There is scarcely a family that is not in want of the commonest necessities. One who has bread for a year is called rich. Among the Jewish population, there are many aged, forsaken widows from Germany, Spain, Portugal, and other countries, so that there are 7 women to 1 man. Jerusalem, notwithstanding its destruction, still contains 4 very beautiful long bazaars, this is the Shuk, such as I have never seen before at the foot of Mount Zion. When I came to Jerusalem, there was a dreadful famine in the land. It continues on, many Jews died of hunger who had been seen a day or two before asking for bread, which nobody could give them. The next day, they were found dead in their houses. Many lived on grass, going out like stags to look for pasture. At present, there is only 1 German Ashkenazic rabbi here who was educated in Jerusalem. I've never seen his equal for humility and the fear of God. He weaves nightly and day when he is not occupied with his studies, and for 6 months he tasted no bread between Shabbos and Shabbos. His food consisting of raw turnips and the remains of St. John's bread, was carob, rubim, which is very plentiful here after the sugar has been taken out of it. In other words, this is already, you know, the psoilus. This is already the remains of the carob after it's gone through the processing of sugar. So really it was almost worthless. You get it for nothing. All the necessities of life, such as meat, wine, olives, and sesame oil, can be had very cheap. The soil is excellent. It is not possible to gain a living by any branch of industry unless it be that of a shoemaker, weaver, or goldsmith. Due in no small part to the influence of Rav Avadya, Yerushalayim grew over the next few years. This is how one writer describes Yerushalayim in the year 1495, 7 years after Rav Avadya's arrival. In Jerusalem, there are about 200 families. who abstain from every sin and fulfill the commandments of the Lord with great zeal. All people without distinction, old and young, gather together in the evenings for prayers. Many remain after the prayer and sermons of the 80-year-old Rabbi Rav Zecharia Sephardi in the synagogue in order to devote themselves to the study of Mishnah and Talmud for 3 hours. Afterwards, they visit the sick and distribute alms according to their means. People here are very benevolent, although they are poor themselves and live on alms. Here in Jerusalem, it is very difficult to earn a living. Even artisans, like workers in gold, smiths, weavers, and tailors, get hardly enough for their daily needs. The physical difficulties of living in Jerusalem didn't seem to have improved in the subsequent years. This is how the Maharal Bach, this Levi ibn Chaviv, describes the situation 43 years later in the year 1538. Not only is the food of the residents of Jerusalem not sumptuous, but it comes to bitterness and grief. Anyone who earns enough to buy the head of a goat and its innards for Shabbos or Yom Tov considers himself as fortunate as if he were released from the house of bondage, became a free man, and now sits amongst the nobility. But for all of the good that the Maharal Bach accomplished during his years in Yerushalayim, he looked at his refusal to accept smicha. As we said before, he was right after Mari Bei Rav was appointed by the rabbinate in Tzfas, you know, as to get the ordination as a judge, it in turn that rabbinate appointed Rav Levi ibn Chaviv. And he looked at, in retrospect, he looked at his refusal to accept that smicha, this ordination, and his vigorous attack against the whole process as one of the crowning achievements of his life. I quote his letter on page 14e. I also say, thank God, at a time when I was sitting with honor and attainment, like the others of my rank in the tents of Torah in the great city of giants, Salonika, I decided to leave there and to come here to Jerusalem. Through his great compassion, he granted me the merit to arise and come there and to dwell in her courtyards together with my family for the last 14 some years. As he wrote this in 1538, so he came in 1524. In addition, he has shown his wondrous kindness to me, giving me the opportunity to grant merit to the public through 2 very important matters, besides for other relatively minor matters. The first was at a time when some fools and liars, may their spirit be destroyed, made false prophecies. Had I not been in the holy city at that time and calmed the people through my gentle approach and convincing arguments, the Jewish population would have been totally destroyed without even the remnant of a minion, as is well known to all its inhabitants. He doesn't clarify this statement at all. I would assume that it would be referring to some sort of a prophecy of the coming of Mashiach and arising and taking arms against the Muslim rulers of the city, which of course you would see would have been totally foolhardy. The second thing, which in my eyes is greater than the first, and he continues on, is that Hashem in his compassion let me be the cause of preventing the restoration of smicha, rabbinic ordination, Eretz Yisrael. For the rabbis in Safed wanted to restore it, despite the fact that according to halacha, we do not have the power to do so. As a result, some of the elder scholars withdrew their support. For this do I give thanks and praise before my God, may he be praised forever. For the sake of his compassion, may he give me the merit of being alive at the time of the true smicha, which will come to be through Eliyahu, Elijah the prophet, and the descendant of David, our righteous Mashiach. Amen. This is taken from Simon Kuf Mem Zion, this is chapter 147 of his Tshuvas, his response. Before we go into greater detail about the whole controversy surrounding smicha, it is worthy to note that even in the period after the passing of the Maharal Bach, life in Yerushalayim was still very difficult. This is what Rav Shmuel Uzida, the author of the Medrash Shmuel, writes in his Lechem Dima. This is a commentary to Eicha, to Lamentations, referring to the verse. This is a Hoysa Lamas. She has become a source of taxation. He writes, this verse can possibly be alluding to what we see in our own times. There is no area within the domains of our king, may his glory be exalted, that has more taxes and levies placed upon the Jews than Eretz Yisrael, most especially Jerusalem. If not for the fact that Jews from all over the world send money to help them to pay the taxes and other levies, the Jewish community there would not be able to survive. So just interesting, and it was alluded to before, that during this whole period of time, monies were constantly being sent from Jews outside of Israel to support Jews who live in Israel. I mean, this process, and it was called the Chalukah, really supported Jews up until modern times. One of the fervent hopes, prayers, and cardinal beliefs of the Jewish people is the restoration of life as it was lived by Jews in biblical times. The Jews will all be gathered back to the land of Israel. The court system and the Sanhedrin, the Supreme Court, will be restored. The Beis HaMikdash, the temple, will be rebuilt. And Mashiach, the Messiah, who will be a descendant of King David, the David HaMelech, will reign. Throughout our history, many people have made calculations predicting the coming of this era. Others have tried to hasten the process. Needless to say, the result of all of this was disappointment, or worse. One Mekubal, one mystic, Yosef de la Reina of Tzfas, decided to hasten the coming of Mashiach together with his five disciples through a program of fasting, mortification of the flesh, prayer, and the use of Kabbalistic incantations. They went to Meron and prostrated themselves on the grave of Shimon bar Yochai, then traveled to Tiberias, to Tveria, where they used their Kabbalistic knowledge to summon forth the divine powers, using Hashem's holy names, to hasten the coming of Mashiach. Needless to say, Mashiach did not arrive. After his failed attempt, Rav Yosef de la Reina left to side in Sidon, where he abandoned Judaism, to the shock of all of his friends and admirers. But the sense of Mashiach's imminent coming seems to have been in the air. The resettlement of Israel, especially Safed, seems to be to many as the Eschalt of the Gula, the beginning of the redemption. After all, there had not been in recent history such a flowering of Torah material success as it was during that period. Shlomo Molcho, the martyr who was burned at the stake in Italy, had written a work titled Sefer HaMefor, in which he seems to hint that Mashiach was destined to come in the year 1539 or 40. It was with this background we can better understand the following events. In the year 1538, the Rabbonim of Tzvas decided to reinstate smicha, ordination of rabbis or dayonim. Smicha, which literally means leaning or support, is a name that is given to the process of appointing judges for the Sanhedrin, the high court, or lower courts, to adjudicate the cases involving the imposing of fines, flogging, and the time of the temple capital punishment. Even though the process of ordination is described by the term smicha, this leaning, there's no actual physical leaning done in the ceremony of ordination. Just a verbal appointment, which is done by the Bezdin in the rabbinic court. From the time of Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu, there was a long chain of appointments or smicha. The judges of each generation made new appointments. Every somuch, someone who was already ordained, could theoretically trace his appointment back to the judge who appointed him, and ultimately all the way back, generation after generation, to Moses, to Moshe Rabbeinu. After the Romans had outlawed smicha, and those already appointed had died out, somewhere at the end of the 4th or 5th or early 5th century, the whole process came to an end. We know, though, that the Sanhedrin will be revived at the coming of Mashiach, or prior to his coming. This is based upon the verse in Yeshaya, Isaiah 1:26, "Oshiva shavtayach kevorishayna." I will restore your judges as they were from the beginning. But how can new judges be appointed if all of the previous appointees who traced their appointment back to Moses have already died out? This is the question of Yaakov Bei Rav addressed in the following tshuva, responsum. Before we begin, and because of the time, we're just going to quote the highlights of these responses. I would like to clarify one point which is very confusing. Today, any rabbi who is ordained receives what is known as smicha, and is called a musmach. The term smicha, commonly used today, however, is really a misnomer, and is not the smicha we're referring to in this lecture. In the time of the Talmud, someone who wanted to paskin, to rule in halachic matters, had to first receive permission from his rabbis, his rebbe, his master. This would be in the form of yora yora. This is in general halachic matters. Literally it means regarding the question, may he rule, yora yora. He may rule. And yodin yodin would be the term for this degree if he would judge in monetary issues. Again, yodin means literally regarding the question, may he judge, yodin, he may judge. This was not an actual appointment of judgeship, merely a testimonial. So regarding his degree of competency without which a person could not issue rulings. This was originally called netilas reshus, or heter hara, receiving authority, permission to issue halachic rulings. But however, it was originally not called smicha. After the original smicha, appointment of judgeship, ceased to exist, people started referring to netilas reshus, permission to rule in halachic matters. They gave it the term smicha. But as we said, this is not the original smicha. You know, this is not the original meaning of the term. What the Rabbonim of Tzfas wanted to restore was the original smicha. Now let's read together, at least from the highlights, from the responsum, the tshuva, regarding these issues. He first begins, and I'll just summarize this, the first tshuva begins with the problem that we stated before. From the Talmud it seems that you need to have this chain. That's why we don't have it, you know, today. It describes an event that took place approximately the year 135, 137 of the Common Era, where the Romans, it seems after their victory at Betar, they crushed the Bar Kokhba rebellion, wanted to destroy the power of the Jews and outlaw this process of smicha, of appointments of judgeships. At a risk of his own life, Rav Yehuda ben Bava gave this ordination to the five leading scholars of the day, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Shimon, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Elazar. The Romans found out about this and killed him. But because he risked his life, the process did not cease. It would seem from that whole discussion, well, today it's gone. So if so, it would seem that it would be impossible to restore smicha today. However, the Rambam Maimonides, both in his commentary to the Mishnah and in the Mishnah Torah, his halachic, his compendium, maintains that it is possible to restore smicha even without having this chain, having this chain of transmission. And he maintains if we have the group of scholars as a whole in Israel come together and make an appointment, they feel someone is fit, and they make an appointment, it could be restored. The whole basis of the restoration that the rabbis in Tzfas and the appointed, this is Yaakov Bei Rav, is based on their understanding of this Rambam. The Rambam, however, after he describes the process, says at the end, he says the words, he says that the matter the matter still needs resolution, which would seem on the surface to indicate that he was still in doubt. Unless he made this whole exposition, because otherwise, you know, how could it be restored? And we know it's going to be restored. And yet he ends off with, it would seem to be his reservation. The thing still needs. It's truly to this issue, the understanding of this, that Rav Yaakov Bei Rav puts his attention. And what we're going to touch upon this in a moment, but basically he maintained that which the Rambam made that statement, Va'adover Tzorach Hechra, the matter still needs resolution, is not referring to the basic idea of the restoration of Smicha when all the scholars can come together. That was not the issue. What it needed was, he was referring really to a very minor matter. When we have all the scholars together, they have to come together? They have to decide. But if we have a living somoch, someone who has ordination before, we don't need the approval of everybody else. We don't need anybody. He himself, on his own, can appoint someone else. You have a living, someone alive right now, who still has ordination, he can give ordination. He doesn't need anybody else's approval. What he does need, however, though, and this is evident from that, from this discussion there in the Talmud, that he needs at least two other people, even though they're not smuchim themselves, they're not ordained, but to be members of the Beis Din to confer the smicha. According to Rav Yaakov Bei Rav, those other two members are really non-voting members. They're there for the discussion. In other words, he hears their opinion. They're there at present. But ultimately, it's the decision of the somoch of the previous appointee to make the appointment. He is just there as a... they're there more in a consultation role than actually in a voting role. He said that idea of what the role of those other two judges is the question which the Rambam said, Adover Tzorach Hechra. Maybe all three have to. Maybe they can't just be merely consultants. They are active members, and if they dissent, then the appointment will not be administered. That is according to the Maribe Rab. That was the question. As the Rambam had no doubts as to the validity of the actual process of restoration, it really was just a minor technical thing when there is no restoration. And we have a somoch, one appointee, who has taken two other members, who are only scholars but not appointees, and they are involved in this process. Are they just there for consultation? Are they actively there for the voting? And if they outvote him, he may be outvoted. That is the question. The Rambam basically maintains that they are just consultants, but then on that point he has his doubts. This is how the Maribe Rav understood this. And after he made his whole exposition, he says the Rambam made his statement. Right, this is in his Yad Chazaka, in the Mishnayos, but in his Halacha Compendium. The Ravid, Rav Ram Ben David, who's a leading scholar in Provence at the time, a contemporary of the Rambam, who wrote many critiques on the Rambam, did not critique this passage. It would seem, by his silence, that he also agreed to this. Well, if the Rambam holds this is so, and the Ravid holds this is so, well, it is so. And that was on page 18, we quote, "Now I'll respond to all the questions cited above." We're going to touch on some of them. And he goes on, "It seems that both the Rambam and the Ravid agree that ordination can be restored." It's on page 18. "If the sage of Eretz Yisrael are in agreement." So that's fine. Was this reading, this understanding of what the Rambam meant, this statement, Hadover Tzorach Hechra, this is the thing, this resolution, does it refer to the restoration as a whole? Maybe it can't be restored. Or does it refer to this technicality of when you do have a somuch, in other words, when you have someone who is an appointee who's going to confer an appointment on somebody else, are the other two members, are they in a capacity of consultation, or rather as voting members? He says that's the thing he was wording. The Marabach says no. The Rambam himself was not sure about the whole thing. He says it's a misreading of the passage of the Rambam. And the Rambam himself wasn't sure. And the Ravid, who was silent, he says, now this is on page 19, this is important, paragraph D. I'm not sure whether the silence of the Ravid is due to his acquiescence, or he remained silent simply because he felt the Rambam himself was unsure. And therefore no scholar in any generation would ever entertain the thought to implement the restoration of Smicha based on this ruling. In other words, he may have disagreed, but the Rambam himself was in doubt, so there was really no reason for him to say anything. After all, if these masters of the world, who were experts in the entire Torah, Mishnah, Talmud, Bavli, and Yerushalmi, Sefri, the Septa, Medrash, and Haggadah, were not able to fully support this issue, nor to demolish this logical structure, how can a relative mosquito like myself with clipped wings of knowledge and understanding do anything big or small? This was the reason Maral Bach felt that the whole process was wrong.
The restoration.
That's why he did not accept it himself and vigorously protested. Now, the problem is, which the Maral Bach struggles with, was the Rambam, and he states it in the Mishnayos, seems to have a proof that this must be so. It has to be restored. Because we know that there's going to be a Beis Din when Mashiach comes. There's going to be a Sanhedrin. There's going to be a court of law. Well, how are they appointed? And if the old process has become extinct, there must be an alternate process. So if we're going to say that the Rambam had reservations, what could those reservations be? So this is what he touches upon, which it's on page 20, just to summarize this. He says he was not... originally he maintained that this court of law, this Sanhedrin, is going to be in place before Mashiach comes, before Eliyahu HaNavi comes. It's going to be in place. Well, of course, the only way to have it in place, and all the other previous appointees had died out, is that it must be spontaneously be restored. In his later years, where he had reservations, he wasn't entirely sure, because maybe the Sanhedrin will only be restored after Mashiach comes and after Eliyahu HaNavi is here. I mean, we know there will be, but it will come afterwards. How will it help us afterwards? Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, this is the prophet, will come back. Elijah was part of the process of the Masorah. He is a link in the Torah, in this chain of Torah transmission. This is the we have in Pirkei Avos. So it means the Moshe kibbol Torah from Sinai. Moses received the Torah from Sinai. Masorah says the Yeshua, he gave it over to Joshua. Yeshua is a Canaan. Joshua to the elders. Zakenim leNeviim, gave it to the prophets. Neviim says Masorah lancha Knesset Agdola. They gave it in terms of the men of the great assembly. The prophets were giants of Torah. Eliyahu is a somuch. Eliyahu has smicha. Well, he'll restore it. Because if you have one somuch, you have one person who has, all he has to do is two other scholars, and you have a basin, you have a court, and they will restore the smicha.
This is the
Rambam. Yeah, this is his argument. In other words, he says, you know, maybe that's why the Rambam had his reservation. Maybe the Rambam, because he wasn't so sure, thinking it over again. In other words, maybe we're not forced to assume that there is because really there's no mention of this. And there's this idea that the community spontaneously can go and restore is not mentioned in the Talmud. The Rambam was forced to this position because how else could it be? But if there is an alternative, maybe it's the alternative. And because of that, this is where Rambam says, maybe that's why. He wasn't sure, but maybe that is the reason why the Rambam had reservation. He continues on, there were actually three letters that were written back and forth. Some of them were very impassioned. For, you know, And in one of these, he adds another point here on page 20. This is between the Mari Beirav and the Maral Bach, the Levi Bim Chaviv. It's back and forth. The Maral Bach makes another point, and he says, the Rambam states that you have all the scholars in Israel. Well, you know, that may be when Mashiach comes, or right before Mashiach comes, everyone's going to be in Israel. But today, most people are outside of Israel. The Rambam's reservation was that maybe, says that what she says simply, says that all in Israel, maybe we have to include everybody across the world. Why just only the scholars of Israel? We assume that when right before Mashiach comes, maybe they'll all be there. But today, they're all over. Only a small minority. I mean, even though they were greats in Tzfas, but there were many, many. So look at all the Polish scholars who were contemporaries. You know, there were many great scholars across the world, and even in the Middle East, the Radvaz was in Egypt. There were many great scholars, so it shouldn't be just the Israel ones, the Israeli ones. So that was another one of his arguments. On page 21, I guess you can look at it yourself. He goes with grave, and he says, he makes another very interesting point here. Even if we assume that the Rambam's, that the Mari Beirav's reading of the Rambam is correct, which he vigorously was opposed to. But he said, I'll give you another point. Even if that is true. But he says, members of the Sanhedrin have to be experts in every area of the Torah, as well as many other sciences which touch upon the Torah. He says, there's no one in this generation, how great the Mari Beirav is, there's no one who is qualified to be a member of the Sanhedrin. So forget the, besides the question how I read the Rambam, it's a moot point. There's no one who is fit for this position. And he makes another very important point on page 22. The Mari Beirav was really bothered, and really it's essential to his, the Rambam says, of all the scholars of Israel come together. There's a ruling in all area of jurisprudence that we go after the majority. Why is it here that we need all of the scholars? So the Mari Beirav meant, of course, that we don't need all the scholars. I mean, but it means the majority is equivalent. When we mean all, we mean the majority, which is the equivalent of all. The Maral Bach responded and says, he says, it's true. But we only follow the majority of the group when all of the members of the group have the opportunity to express their opinions to the other members of the group. And after everyone has fully argued the points, and then they come to a vote, we follow the majority. But if you have all the 25 rabbis in Tzfas, maybe we have two in Jerusalem, but the 25 in Tzfas did not hear the arguments and counter arguments because it wasn't thought out. There's a member of in a Sanhedrin, there are all kinds of opinions, and one raises a point and it's shot down, and someone brings another point. After all the discussion, and they have been totally, everyone knows what everyone else's opinion is, then you finally come to a final vote, then we follow the majority. He says, this is not that. And since we need all the scholars, he says, you didn't hear us. And therefore the original vote is invalid. It's a very telling. And this is an additional point that he made. There's another point here. He does not, even though it's implied on a certain level, but in the original document stating why was it so important to make this smicha, this ordination? Why was it so important? Like, what's Brent? You know, Jews have lived there for since this thing. It's been, you know, it's how many years? 1,300 years they lived for, 1,200 years without the smicha. I mean, they survived. They can survive. What was it so important? So of course there was the unspoken idea, which is, you know, Mashiach is coming. You know, it has to be a Sanhedrin. They didn't speak this out. But one thing that was made public was the idea you had all these Spanish Jews who originally had, at least publicly, been involved in the Catholic service, which they deemed to be a form of idolatry. Well, this is one is it commits idolatry, the punishment is chorus. It's a cutting off. It's a terrible punishment. We also know that flogging malchus, administered by a court, is instead of the chorus. In other words, if one gets malchus, one gets flogged by the court, it relieves the punishment of chorus, which is a much more severe, this cutting off, this divine retribution is much more severe. So all these people who came, who regretted their actions of having, they didn't leave earlier, whatever it was, and they publicly were involved in the Catholic service, wanted an expiation of all their sins. And this, if there would be a Sanhedrin, and there would be Dayonim, who have smicha, and therefore their malchus, the flogging, would have halachic validity of flogging, their sins would be expiated. And this is what the Maharibe Rav argued. There is a problem here. Normally, in the times of these, you know, when actually it was an act of Beis Din, the only time that flogging would be mandated if the person had a warning and there were witnesses. A person doesn't normally volunteer to be flogged, I mean, generally. And the question is, what about a voluntary flogging? Does that have the weight? Does that carry with it the benefits, you know, the spiritual benefits of flogging? The Maharibe Rav argued it does. And he quoted several sources, and the Maharal Bach clearly says that it does not.
One would go to his friend?
No. So that's what Maharibe Rav said. No, you need a Sanhedrin. You need a court of law. It has to be administered. But it could be done voluntarily. If one admits, listen, I did this crime, I want to be flogged, the courts would be allowed to do so. And he does find, he does cite sources where we do, on page 23, where we do find a precedent of a court administering voluntary, you know, flogging on a voluntary basis. But the Maharal Bach says that's fine, but we know that, you know, any suffering has a certain form of expiation, but it's not that flogging. The flogging which was meant by the Talmud, which completely takes care, is a substitute, can only be flogging which is done under the auspices of a court, under witnesses and warning, and under the whole legal process when it's administered as a punishment, not as a voluntary process of attaining atonement. So the Maharal Bach really argues even on the whole public, you know, the rationale of creating the smicha. As we said before, it seems to be really a hidden agenda having to do with Mashiach, which he brings out. He also does imply Maharal Bach in his response, because he became very impassioned, that the only reason, I mean, it would seem to him that if one reads the Rambam and one reads the sources, there's no reason to have the smicha. Why does the Maharibe Rav, why was he so insistent? Was because it was through his bidding that this whole process came. And he maintains is that basically he felt that this is the preparation for Mashiach. The prediction, 1540, I mean, and they felt, they saw every, all indication, you know, that this messianic era is coming, so. Yeah.
Were these letters publicly?
Yes, yeah. We'll see. Just hold on. The end was the majority of scholars in Tzfas maintained the side of Maharibe Rav, and they did. They went through the smicha. Yeah, they went through the smicha. A few months after this, though, there were informers to the government that claim that there's this whole Jewish conspiracy here, you know, to reinstate the judgeships. They want this monarchy, you know, and he had to flee for his life, the Marie Beirav. He appointed four scholars, because he didn't know if he ever returned back to Israel, and he didn't want the whole thing to fall into he appointed four scholars. Two of those scholars were Rav Yosef Karo and Rav Moshe ben Yosef of Trani the Mabit. There's a question who the other two scholars were. One opinion has it there was Avram Sholem and Yisrael de Koril, who were the leading poskim, the halachic authorities of that day. There is another version that has it the substitutes for last two were Moshe Cordovero, Rav Yosef Sagis. We know we're leading rabbis of Tzfas. The problem with that version is that Moshe Cordovero at that time was only 16 years old. So it's, even though he probably was a prodigy, but it was just very unlikely in a place with all the other great scholars that he would have been the one appointed. This is after the death of Marie Beirav. The original appointees still maintained that they were appointees, as they disagreed with the Maralbach. Rav Yosef Karo gave ordination to Moshe Alshech, who's a famous Darshan preacher and scholar, and Moshe Alshech in turn gave smicha to Rav Chaim Vital, who was the famous disciple of the Arizal, of Yitzhak Luria. He was a famed, Rav Chaim Vital was a famed, of course, Kabbalist, but in order, if you can imagine, to get smicha, they only gave smicha they felt were the greatest Talmudic halachic scholars. Another one of those that Rav Yosef Karo gave smicha to was Rav Yaakov ben Avram, a recognized halachic authority who was a grandson of Marie Beirav. He in turn gave smicha to seven other scholars. However, in the year 1599, in light of the controversy, these seven scholars agreed not to ordain any other scholars without Rav Yaakov ben Avram's approval. And he did not give approval. When these scholars died, it came to an end. He was the last of the Musmachim. Evidently, it seems, the time was not ripe. At the very end, the last page here, I quote from the Radvaz, Radov ben Zimra. He was asked what his opinion was. He was from the leading rabbis of the period of time, in that period. He goes through the whole process, and he says that basically on every single point he agrees with the Maralbach, Levi ben Chavid. And his opinion, of course, carried with a tremendous weight. As we every day we pray three times a day, you know, Hoshiva Shevtenu Kvarishoina, may you restore our judges as they originally were. May we all merit to see in our lifetime fulfillment of that prayer.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.